Right, so thanks for this. Although this is outside of the Type 1A business, this is a field that I think I've worked very closely with Ken, and so it's nice to talk about this in at this occasion. And I have, of course, reserved the privilege to use the term hypernova without having to be shy about it, maybe for the last time, I don't know, but this is going to recap a bit of the history of my involvement with Ken and in a sense, of the history of Type 1BC explosions and our connection with gamma ray bursts. So just as a brief recap, we've seen spectra, and just as to remind you the differences between 1Bs, 1Cs, and 1As, which have been the topic of the meeting here, and that is, as we've heard, the strong silicon line is a characteristic of 1As. The absence of that suggests a supernova is a core collapse supernova, and then the presence of helium suggests a massive star only stripped of its hydrogen envelope, and the absence of helium and the presence of only heavier elements suggests the helium envelope was lost as well. Type 1Cs were thought to be sort of one and a single type, but then in the last 10 years or so, they have shown to cover quite a range of properties, and in particular, what we'll be talking about here is what we know as hypernovae. Oops, what's going on here? Which are characterized by having broad lines, and we take that to be a signature of high energy and large masses at fairly large ejection expansion velocities. So this is just a recap of the progenitor scenario that we've got in mind, separating the type 1, the type 2s from the type 1Bs and type 1Cs, depending on how much of the stellar envelope was lost before the explosion. This can happen either in a wind or because of binary interaction. This remains to be seen, although there are suggestions based on actually what we observe. So a normal type 1C used to be characterized by a standard 10 to the 51 ergs of energy, very little production of nickel 56, about 10 to the 51, about 0.1 of a solar mass, which is very similar to things like 87A and so on. So everything was thought to be quite normal up until a KITP, or at the time ITP meeting 10 years ago, which Craig and others were organizing. And this is when this interesting supernova came about called 97EF, which had very broad lines. And we were sitting here in one of the rooms trying to discuss what this could be. And at some point we produced spectra based on one of Ken's explosion models that had a standard 1 foe of energy and about 6 solar masses, so not too massive. And what we got by computing spectra from something that fitted the Lyapunov quite nicely was that the absorption lines in the spectrum were way too narrow compared to the observations. That's more or less when we left KITP, went home and kept on thinking, you know, what the hell was this? We didn't have to wait too long, though, because nature came to our rescue, giving us this connection between a gamma ray burst and another supernova. And as if 97EF was a warning, this thing had even broader lines than 97EF. So we were given a warning sign. Now we sort of knew what was going on. This thing, 98BW, was a lot brighter than 97EF. It was as bright as a type 1A. Now we sort of had some hint that the lines being broad was not just a one-off thing. And it was quicker at that point to understand that all you had to do is increase the kinetic energy, and you would get something that looks not too bad. And the reason you have to do that is that if you just assume a single value for the kinetic energy, because of the relation between the width of the curve and the energy, the ejected mass, and the opacity, you can basically get a fit to the light curve for any combination of mass and kinetic energy. So as long as you stick to a single value, you'll have a low mass, and the spectrum may not necessarily look right. But once you're free to change that value, you're going to determine another pair of E and M values. And if you keep looking at various pairs, you might end up with something that looks okay. And that's just what we did. And this is just to compare. We went back to 97EF and, you know, refitted 97EF for now a much larger energy and a slightly larger ejected mass. Both fits to the light curve look quite as nice, just as nice. But the spectra now are distinctly broader. So maybe not quite as broad as the observations, but certainly much better than what we had in our first go at it. So that clearly must have been the major error we were making by not changing the kinetic energy. And I think it was, you know, fortuitous that EF happened just before 98 BW. So you do the same for 98 BW, we came with the gamma ray burst. And here is a set of, you know, possible pairs of energies and masses to fit a light curve. But of course, not all of these models will give you good-looking spectra. So you try all of these, and then eventually you end up with one model called, for reasons that I am willing to explain, but should, you know, raise people's attention, CO138, and this is not accidental, that gives you a fit to the spectra that is not too bad. I mean, the lines are very broad, especially here in the red, the oxygen, the calcium blend. The silicon line does exist. It's sort of a broad glitch in the data. And all the rest is fairly heavy elements, iron, cobalt, titanium. The thing that strikes you if you read those numbers is the kinetic energy you derive from this fit is 50 times what people have been thinking the standard supernova energy should be. Now, that's in cyclic symmetry. The number may be smaller than that, but it certainly is a big number, which is why we initially started using the term hypernova. Then we had to sort of change our ways because, you know, there was broad lined with low energies and all sorts of things, which I think is why one of the reasons why this term is debated these days. What you can do to understand more about what is going on is, instead of only looking at the early phase when the supernova is bright, is to wait until the gas becomes transparent. The supernova is a lot fainter then. It's not as easy to observe, but you can learn a lot about what goes on inside. Because the gas is now emitting as a nebula, so it doesn't have any radiation effect. You see right through it, and you can see what the inner workings of the thing actually were. In a classical sort of constant density spherical situation, you expect parabolic emission profiles of nebula lines, mostly forbidden, excited by the energy deposited by the gamma rays and the positrons of those late phases. The thing we were not expecting is that we were in for more surprises as we looked at the late time spectra of 98 BW. And in particular, the thing to look at here, you've seen this many times before, is the oxygen line looking fairly narrow and the iron line looking fairly broad. And now if you've got your own picture of a star in mind, the oxygen sits above the iron, and therefore if you explode this thing, you should have faster oxygen motion than iron motion. So having that suggests something is going on, but we know what was going on. What was going on is there was a GRB there, so this was not a spherically symmetric event. It is a fairly easy connection then to say, well, this was an spherical explosion. We viewed this not too far from some axis along which there was a lot of fireworks in the gamma rays, in the X-rays, and whatever. And because of our preferred orientation, we had a chance to see most of the region where the iron was made move towards us, which is why we see broad iron lines. There's iron coming this way, and there's iron probably going the other way as well. The oxygen, on the other hand, doesn't get affected by the nucleosynthesis at the time of explosion, and it tends to go out tangentially, more or less, with respect to our line of sight, and so we pick lower velocities. It doesn't actually mean the velocities are intrinsically low, it's just what we see. And so you do 3D nebula spectra of those. The spherical expectation gives you a flat top for the oxygen, because the oxygen should be in a shell. So that's not what you see. What you see is corresponding exactly to that sort of configuration. Narrow oxygen, I don't know what's going on with the connection. Oh, because I'm on battery, maybe. All right, maybe I should go. Right. Battery is full, actually. Anyway, so what corresponds to this model is this sort of profile where the oxygen is narrow and the iron line blend makes that feature and it makes it fairly broad. So not only could we confirm the large nickel mass giving rise to this feature here, but we could also sort of take a guess, an educated guess, as to our orientation with respect to this model. And that turned out to be not too far from the jet axis, which is nice because that is a condition to observe any GRB. And to confirm that later on, as we were looking at other examples of aspherical supernavae, we came upon this object, O3JD, which was bright, almost as bright as 98 Pw, did not make a gamma ray burst. But in the oxygen line at late phases showed a double peak profile, indicating we were viewing the same event, or a fairly similar event, but now from close to the equator, in a sense. So you're looking at the oxygen in its plane. And you just take the same model, turn it around, view it from a different point of view, and that's the oxygen line profile that you get. So that's a nice confirmation of our picture of 98 Pw. Of course, one of the questions that were asked then was this thing also a gamma ray burst hypernova sort of event? Now, I think all observations seem to exclude that any X-ray gamma ray event ever happened, given the limits of the detection. But I think those limits aren't, they're fairly deep. So the points in the radio and the X-rays are below what one would expect from a model even off axis. So this thing may not have made a gamma ray burst, but on the other hand, it was a similar type of explosion as 98 Pw. That goes, it's in line with data from polarimetry showing that polarization of 1BCs is higher than in type 2s. Polarization in type 2s goes up with time. So all these points to the same sort of scenario where the inner workings of the core collapse are fairly highly aspherical. Now, most people in the supernova game believe the connection. People in the GRB game didn't believe the connection until the second event, which is a few years later, showing basically the same sort of supernova connected now with a much more powerful GRB, although it was further away. And you look at those spectra, now they're noisy because the distance is more, and there was a much stronger GRB afterglow to work against. But you sort of do a fit of the light curve in the spectra, and you come up with, again, values that are very large, both in nickel mass, in ejected mass, and in kinetic energy. So that is, again, a spherically symmetric estimate. If you take it down, take into account the sort of aspherical model we've discussed before, these numbers go down by a factor of, let's say, 4 or 5. So you go down to about 10 times the standard supernova energy, which is still fairly large. A third event that we could get spectroscopic data for was O3LW in GRB O3. So that shows that most, at this point, given the most recent evidence of the nearby GRBs for which we can detect a supernova, if a supernova is there, host a bright, energetic core collapse supernova of type 1C. Yeah. And so if we just go back to the variety of type 1C supernovae here, we can build a sort of preliminary spectral classification based on essentially the energy per unit mass. More energy per unit mass makes the lines become broader. So the more energy you have per unit mass, again, the broader your lines will be. At low energy, 10 to the 51 Hertz, you have your classical, if you still want to use that word, because there really is a big variety there. There you get your classical 1C spectrum, and then as the energy goes up, more and more lines blend, and you get towards the hypernova type spectrum. Because we have these nice explosion models, we can make a connection with the properties of the stars that gave rise to these events. And there is a nice correlation between the kinetic energy, the nickel mass produced, and the mass of the progenitor, indicating that only the most massive stars ever make the hypernova GRBs. Lower than that, you have broad-lined events that don't make a GRB. And further down still, you have your normal events. The three reasonably well-observed gamma ray burst hypernovae have very different GRB properties. Now, this may be an inclination effect, but it may also be just the nature of the GRB being buried, indicating the GRB doesn't really care what goes on below, and it may be strong, it may be weak, but it's somewhat unrelated, although it is deeply physically related with what goes on down at the site of collapse. It is also interesting that, essentially, for almost no other type 1BC supernova, there has been a radio detection. And if these things are beamed, you would expect, like in the case of O3JD, you'd expect there to be some off-axis events which you should be able to pick up in the radio. And that doesn't seem to have been the case. So that's an interesting question. You know, what is going on? Is our expectation about the environment not correct? Or is a jet not as, you know, is the beam not as narrow as one would expect that it is? But that's, I think, one of the interesting questions that need addressing in the future. Another thing that was hinted at by the orientation problem is, do X-ray flashes, the weak equivalents of GRBs, also come from the same sort of event? And this other KITP hit, because it also happened when we were here last year on a supernova GRB program, so hopefully we'll have one this year as well. This event came to the rescue. It wasn't in an X-ray flash fairly nearby. The supernova is called 06AJ, so it was February of last year. It's got intermediate properties in brightness between the hypernovae, GRB things, and the non-GRB broad line events, and the narrow light curve here is a normal type 1C. So this thing is in between. Again, if we do spectral fitting and light curve fitting simultaneously, we find properties that are somewhat above the normal, but not so much, only about a factor of 2 in energy. So that's a nice link between normal and hyper. The mass isn't very large, the nickel mass is not very large, so this is something in between. It's in between in velocity as well, so all of its properties seem to indicate that this is an intermediate event. The Leica fits, as I said, looks quite good. The nebula spectra show a strong oxygen one line as expected. The mass that we derive is not very large. And there is no sign of asphericity, no sign of major asphericity in the spectra. So, as was already deduced from the early properties, this thing was not very highly beamed. So what we think happened in this particular case is something a bit different from the supernova GRB situation. In order to have low ejected mass, a lot of nickel 56 produced, you should have a star that is not very massive at the beginning, but you should also have a remnant that isn't very big. Otherwise, you won't not have enough nickel 56 in the ejector. So you're more or less, you know, led to the conclusion that the remnant can only have been a neutron star, because then enough nickel 56 would have emerged. And then there is an interesting link. You know, if this was a neutron star, there's no collapser at this point. So how do you make the X-ray flash? Well, the possibilities of the neutron star had a magnetic field. It was rapidly spinning, and a magnetar basically energized the explosion, gave rise to the X-rays, and to what we actually observed. So if we place this object in context, we tend to sort of place it on the neutron star side of the fate of these stars. The star is not very massive. If we place this line here between sort of 20 and 25, 06AJ seems to be on the neutron side, neutron star side of things. And so we may be looking at a situation where, depending on rotational properties, on whatever, you don't have to make a black hole. You can just make a neutron star, but you'll get a signature in the X-rays. This, of course, needs to be confirmed with other objects, but the indications from the calculations are fairly stringent. And this is a fairly busy table, but this is just to show that, you know, you get the GRB at the highest mass, highest energy end of things, but you also can get it at the highest end of the neutron star making supernovae. So to put it all together, what we think we are looking at, if the star is very massive, like 35 or 50 or whatever, and depending on rotation, stripping, or whatever else, after it collapses a black hole, it can make a GRB and a powerful supernova explosion, which we call a hypernova. If the star is not massive enough to make a black hole, it may cause an XRF by magnetic activity. And of course, this may come in pairs. It is one easy way to strip the star and set it into, you know, high spin. And these may then be sites for, you know, Schauhauer GRBs as the soft gamma ray repeater phase occurs with a spinning neutron star, and later even soft hard GRBs by neutron star merger eventually. So what is next? Of course, some of the questions are here. There are many more. Are all these things are all these long GABs supernovae? I mean, there's some recent evidence that GABs can come without at least bright supernovae. Are the properties of GABs determined entirely by their own physical properties? What is the inclination? What is the role of the inclination in that? What is the relation between GABs and XRFs? We think we've answered some of that, but can some GABs viewed way off the side look like XRFs? That remains a question. Progenitors, well, we sort of think we know what they are, but are they single stars? Are they in binaries? And, you know, to ask yourself the question, can these things be used to for cosmology is an interesting one that, you know, I think we don't have an answer for as yet. So just to conclude, this is Japan more or less right now. Today, or actually yesterday, was a holiday in Japan. This is the vernal equinox, so March 21st was a holiday. And to celebrate this, which is on Ken's day, cherry blossoms actually occurred about a week earlier than they normally do in Tokyo. So, and so I have to write this down because my Japanese is so good, but Tanjoubi omedeto, Kenichi.
Thanks for that nice tour of the exotica here. There's a question from the past president of the AAS back here.
Late president of the AAS.
Hiding in the glare of the light. Wait, is this on?
It is.
I think it's on.
That's what all the questioners are.
I just wanted to bring up a little more about the nature of the 1Cs, because I think it is a very interesting question. There are broadline 1Cs, and there are broadline 1Cs that are associated with gamma ray bursts. And there are other differences, some of which you didn't highlight, between those two, that are worth thinking about in the big context. So they are that the luminosity, the optical luminosity of the supernova 1Cs that are associated with the gamma ray bursts are a lot bigger than the ones that are in the broadline, the other broadline ones. So there's it's not the breadth of the line so much that is telling you about the energy. It's the luminosity of the supernova that pushes you toward those models.
Right.
Isn't that right?
One of the plots, right?
Yeah. And the other thing is this other interesting clue that probably is telling us something about the stellar evolution that goes before, that Mariam Mojes, my student, has been working on so hard, which is to measure the chemical composition of the galaxies in which the 1Cs have taken place. And the ones that have the gamma rays, of course, have very low metal abundance, and that probably is a clue to the path of stellar evolution that leads you to the case where you get both the 1C spectrum, the high luminosity, and the gamma ray burst.
Other questions, comments for Powell? You don't have an opinion on this topic, do you?
In response to Bob's comment, I think actually, you know, this is a fantastic example of not every GRB supernova looks like 98BW, and in fact, this one wasn't very bright, right? I mean, that's the what makes it so exciting. So, I think we should be very careful in saying that all GRB supernovae are bright, because that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, and this was an X-ray flash, so in a sense.
Well, I mean, we have other data too. If you look at all the, you know, the ones that don't have spectra, okay, some people throw them out, but they, you know, a lot of HST time went into those observations, and we don't see that every GRB supernova is as bright as 98BW, and that's just the bottom line. Okay, that's a different question. Yeah.
Thanks. Other questions, comments on hypernovae?
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
I'm always amazed coming to the supernova meetings. The level of desperation is really heavy here. You know, there are upper limits. I don't know why our ex-president doesn't wish to acknowledge these upper limits. Not all of them are bright. So we have examples of supernovae which have broad lines and not GRBs or any sign of GRB, despite obvious papers like, is 2002 AP a hypernova? Question mark. Of course, the answer is no, which should have been the real title of the paper. Anyway, I think you guys want to, it's like you have a story, and you want to tailor all these observations to your story.
Well, we explain the observations, and we don't explain the lack of observations. Maybe that's the answer to this.
tree has no story at all.
Just about this last one, where you thought that maybe a neutron star could have been made, it seems to me, even if you make something like a 3 or 4 solar mass carbon-oxygen core, I mean, having had a Wolf-Rayet history before that, the star must have been more massive than 20. I would rather guess it to have been 30 or something. But, yeah, it depends all, of course, on mass loss things, but it seems to me it's just the final end that you have in your hand before this thing explodes, and that it could easily have started out much more massive.
I think the core to mass ratio is something that people that do stellar evolution can answer better than this, right?
Yeah, but you have to fold in mass loss. Wolf-Rayet lose lots of mass, of course.
You're looking down at the carbon oxygen core.
Yeah.
The mass loss affects how the core develops, but it doesn't actually change the mass. So.
Yeah. Well, it's just my gut feeling. Much more.
Then you would shift all the other masses up.
Nope.
Right? Yeah, fine.
Other questions, comments here? Okay, very stimulating. Let's thank Paolo again, and we'll take a break.